Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
A warming battleground for the new Cold War. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The Arctic's waters are full of ships, but few of them are flying a U.S. flag. 41 Russian icebreakers patrol busy shipping channels, and that nation's laid claim to more than 500,000 square miles of the region's seabed. China, South Korea, and Singapore are also vying to be polar expedition superpowers. Now, with President Obama's Arctic trip, the U.S. is seeking a foothold in a region where climate change holds both promises and perils. Can America catch up with its rivals? And on today's Talking Point, jail time instead of psychiatric help. How an arrest for stealing snacks ended in death for one mentally ill young man. First news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
It's To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. Just ahead, the president ends his Alaska visit today with more calls for action on climate change. But is the U.S. taking urgent enough action to get a foothold in the northern polar region, where Russia, China, and other nations have already staked claims? The steaming up of the new Cold War in the Arctic. That's next. And on today's Talking Point, how did a mentally ill man jailed for stealing junk food die? We'll hear about the case of Jamichael Mitchell and what it says about the lack of psychiatric care for inmates. First, this news update. The Obama administration now appears to have enough congressional votes in favor of the president's nuclear deal with Iran. Today, Maryland Senator Barbara Mikulski became the 34th Democrat to support the president's plan. For more, we're joined by Jonathan Weissman. He's the deputy Washington editor for the New York Times and author of the new book, Number 4, Imperial Lane. And Jonathan Weissman, great to have you on the show.
I'm glad to be here.
So Senator Mikulski stressed the importance of international cooperation on the Iran deal. What else did she say?
I think that this is actually the key that has swayed so many Democrats, and ultimately I think will sway more than just these 34, which is that the problem here is you had the international community united to impose very, very stringent economic sanctions on Iran. And when President Obama pushed these sanctions, he said, we are going to be imposing these sanctions to get Iran to the negotiating table. They got Iran to the negotiating table. They got a deal. And now the other partners in the negotiations, Britain, France, Germany, China, Russia, these are not our enemies. They've had enough. They don't want to have they are ready to lift the sanctions. So if you can't reimpose the international sanctions, most of these Democrats have concluded you can't demand a quote-unquote better deal. This is the deal you've got.
Then this is as good as it's going to get, right? And that's why we're hearing from Democrats this kind of supportive but very cautious stance.
Exactly. They're not saying, oh, yeah, everything's going to go perfectly smoothly. But they do see that, look, if you can't reimpose the sanctions, two things can happen. You can go to war, or you can actually watch Iran actually accelerate its drive to a nuclear weapon. And they've decided that they would rather take the chance that these sanctions, sanctions and new restrictions on the nuclear deal will work, because obviously nothing's been taken off the table. If you still want to go to war, you can still do it later.
Right. And just to get in our civics lesson, explain the significance of this 34th vote, this rule by minority, not majority, and why is that all the administration needs?
Yes, it is an odd situation. Remember, way back in May, the Congress passed something called the Iran Review Act, which said that Congress actually does get a say in this. in that they get to look at the deal, they get time to ponder it, to debate it, and after that that set period, which actually ends September 16th, they either can vote a resolution of approval, a resolution of disapproval, or they could do nothing. But whatever they do, it's a bill. It's actually legislation. So if they pass this resolution of disapproval that Republicans want to put on the floor, President Obama can just veto it, and the bill and the Iran deal goes through, unless Congress can override the veto. And to override a veto, you need two-thirds of the Senate and two-thirds of the House. Two-thirds of the Senate means you need 67 senators. Well, if you have 34 Democrats saying they're not going to do that, you can't override a veto. And President Obama sure as heck is going to veto a resolution of disapproval.
And I hope everyone took notes on that. Now, how are GOP leaders in Congress responding?
You know, they believe that they have at least a good political issue. And they're going to push forward with this one way or another. They want to get Democrats and Republicans on record on a vote. Now, the big question, if there is a question out there, the big question is whether or not this resolution of disapproval will be amended, will be open to amendment. Because if it's open to amendment, boy, all sorts of mischief could happen. You could have Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida and presidential candidate, has been talking about adding an amendment that says that Iran must recognize the right of Israel to exist. There's another amendment that would say that the deal cannot go into force unless American citizens who are being held in Iranian prisons are released. These would be amendments that would be very difficult to vote against if you're a Democrat. They're tailor-made for 30-second TV ads, right?
Right, and just very quickly, the deadline for the vote is September 7th, and Congress
September 17th,
and Congress could act as early as next week. What is this timeline?
I mean, they're in a very big hurry because, as we've all seen, the United States Senate, when it wants to get bogged down, can take a very long time. So I think that they will be taking a vote next week.
Jonathan Weissman with the New York Times, thanks so much for taking the time to talk
you.
With me. And when we come back, climate change creates a new Cold War in the Arctic. Stay with us for that conversation on To the Point from PRI.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
It's To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Warren Olney. Well, so far on his Alaska trip, the president has hiked a glacier, taken a boat ride, and talked a lot about rising seas and the urgent need to cut back on greenhouse gas emissions. He's also called for more Coast Guard icebreakers and an expanded U.S. presence in the Arctic. But the U.S. lags behind nations like Russia and China, which have already staked claims to the rich Arctic seabed. And scores of their icebreakers patrol the ever-increasing shipping channels. Today, Obama becomes the first president to enter the Arctic Circle, and he'll touch down briefly in the small village of Kotzebue, where Shell Oil is renting hotel space and rising seas are devastating regional food sources like caribou and seals. This is a story full of contradictions, and Alex DeMarbon is a reporter with the Alaska Dispatch News in Kotzebue, Alaska, where the president is due to spend a few hours later today. Hi, Alex.
Hi there.
I understand you just stepped out of a meeting about the president's imminent arrival.
What this was essentially a press conference of regional tribal leaders. There are 12 tribal governments in this region, in this Kotzebue region of Northwest Alaska, where Kotzebue is the hub. And anyway, these tribal leaders from these various villages who have flown in to hopefully talk with the president, were meeting with the press to talk about concerns that they have seen with climate change.
And what what are those concerns? What are they saying?
Well, they talk about the ice breaking up more quickly in the spring. In other words, melting earlier and becoming softer so that it's the seals that reside in that ice are more difficult to catch because the ice is breaking up and going away. So the hunting season has gotten shorter for that. It's also more difficult to ride your snow machine to go get a seal on the ice because of the softer ice. There's a lot of rains now in the winter when there did not used to be, and that's covering up moss and forage that the caribou need to eat. It's covering it up with ice because that rain freezes, and then they can't break through that ice. There's a variety of other problems that they mentioned, including just the ability to travel is difficult. So barges that would deliver supplies up to these villages went, you know, to last through the winter, you know, heating fuel, for example, to heat homes. The rivers are lower, so the barges are not able to get up the rivers as often as they used to be able to. So sometimes fuel has to be flown into these villages, dramatically increasing the cost. Gas is like more than $10 a gallon in a lot of these places.
With such intimate acquaintance with the effects of greenhouse gases, what are leaders thinking about Arctic drilling?
In this region of Northwest Alaska, they are not going to benefit at this point as dramatically as other parts of the state would. So they're pretty ambivalent on Arctic drilling. They don't want to lose any opportunities. If there is a discovery, they'd like to see that tribes and local communities, for example, get a share of the revenue. But they're most concerned about subsistence and their, you know, their caribou and their salmon that they've long caught and still want to catch to continue feeding themselves in the winter, since there's not a lot of grocery stores up here in these remote locations.
I imagine. Help us experience what's going on there right now. How is the town preparing for the president's visit? What's the mood?
Everyone's super excited, of course. People, even if they may not agree with all the president's policies or any of them, they're really excited that he's coming. I think there's a lot of support for Obama's policies here in general, particularly his efforts to reach out to tribes. But there are some people who, you know, are more conservative. But it's also a polite community, so they're not telling me, for example, what their beef is with the president. They'll just say they're more conservative, but they're really happy he's here. So,
and they've taken great pains.
It's a very welcoming town.
To spruce up the town, right?
Yeah, that's one of the key things. So in rural Alaska, because, you know, you need barges that may come once a year to deliver things, once you have a car that's barged in or maybe even flown in, you're not going to get rid of that. So there's tons of just junk rotting in yards because you might need that spare part one day that's in that piece of junk. So anyway, Kotzebue cleaned up. You know, they removed more than 100 old vehicles that were just rusting away in yards, and they demolished 10 homes, and more than 100 dump truck loads just in the last few weeks have left yards, and there's just 3,400 people here. So it's been this huge, dramatic effort to clean everything up. And that's one way they prepared for the president. People are also setting out flags, of course, and getting their signs ready.
Alex DeMarvin, he's a reporter with the Alaska Dispatch News in Kotzebue, where President Obama will be arriving later today. Francis Ulmer is chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, appointed by President Obama in 2011, and good of you to join us as well.
My pleasure.
Now, you were just with the president on Monday night. What would you agree with what Alex just said about these tribal leaders and that community and their ambivalent support for oil drilling?
There is no doubt that there are pluses and minuses associated with drilling for oil in Alaska. But the vast majority of Alaskans support oil development because it's a third of our economy. although most of the development to date has been on land, not on shore, there has been some. It's really important to remember that the leases right now out in the Chukchi that Shell is proceeding with were actually agreed upon under the previous administration, not under the Obama administration. But I think what's really important to note is that the additional requirements to reduce risk and improve safety that have been required of Shell and will be required of other entities that want to drill in the Arctic because of the proposed regs that the Department of Interior has come out with really raises the bar. So, yes, it's still controversial, and there is concern about whether or not the technology will stand up to the challenging conditions of the Arctic. But in general, there is support for moving forward in some parts. For example, the North Slope Borough, which is further to the north and further to the east of the area where Alex is right now, the large native corporation in that region, the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, is running full-page ads in the Anchorage paper about how they want oil development to go forward. So it's very much a mixed bag. I think the important point to note here is that the standards have been raised considerably, and some of those have been controversial. Some of them the industry hasn't been wild about, but it definitely is an important move in the direction of the U.S. setting higher standards, regardless of who's doing the development. And hopefully some of the other countries that are moving forward with oil development in the Arctic also will follow our lead in really stepping up these requirements to reduce risk.
Well, given the ambivalence and the complexity of these issues that you're talking about, are the charges that the president has been getting of hypocrisy on framing this trip to Alaska as a call for action on climate change just weeks after giving this go-ahead for Shell Oil to begin drilling there, are those charges justified?
Well, let's remember that once a company has a lease, whether it's Shell or anybody else, and they've paid billions of dollars for it, the only way to actually withdraw the real approval for that is for Congress to appropriate the money to buy back those leases. And I think that's highly unlikely. So when a company has a lease and is moving forward under the regulations and under the additional requirements that the Department of Interior has put and other agencies have put on Shell, then it is the way our country works. We're a country of law. So when that is a given, I think what's really important to focus on, and this has certainly been the president's message here this week, which is we have an obligation as a nation, and the entire world has an obligation to do everything we can to find alternative sources of energy. Because let's face it, folks who are driving cars in Los Angeles and people who want to heat their homes in Chicago still want energy, right? So you got to work the demand side of reducing demand by more efficiency, and you have to work the alternative supply by assuring that the renewable energy alternatives that we are developing in our country, and many other countries are too, that we step up the investment that's required to do that. We're in a period of transition, Barbara, between being dependent upon oil and gas and moving toward an entirely different energy economy. And he is calling for us to step it up. And I think his message of urgency, both in terms of reducing the demand for oil and gas and increasing alternatives, is incredibly important.
So working both sides of the energy coin. Frances Ulmer is chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, appointed by President Obama back in 2011. Alex DeMarvin with the Alaska Dispatch News. Given the safety issues that Frances Ulmer raised and she asserted that safety has come a long way since, for instance, the Exxon Valdez, how well do Alaskans remember that oil spill? You know, is it fresh enough that they're skeptical about these kinds of safety assurances?
It's certainly in everyone's mind still. It's not the first thing necessarily that's mentioned when these discussions are happening today. But, of course, no one can forget such a tragic event. So it's still there. People do feel, I think, a bit more comfortable, or I should say a lot of people do feel a bit more comfortable with the additional security measures that have been put up there on drilling. But still, people won't forget the Exxon Valdez. It's an iconic event in our history.
Alex DeMarmon with the Alaska Dispatch News in Kotzebue, where the president will visit later today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
David Titley joins us now. He's director of Penn State University Center for the Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk. He's a meteorologist and former oceanographer and navigator for the U.S. Navy. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Barbara.
Well, let's talk about national security, and we have a few minutes to do that, and we'll continue talking about that in the second half of our show. Could you tease out the link between melting ice and U.S. security concerns?
Well, sure. I mean, very simply, what's happening is we used to, not too many years ago, have an Arctic that basically stayed frozen for the entire year. There would be little pieces that would melt at the edges, but much of the Arctic Ocean, and it's a maritime environment. It's an ocean that's surrounded by land. It's a maritime environment. It was covered with hard, thick, what the scientists would call multi-year ice that made it, for all intents and purposes, impassable, except for a heavy icebreaker, and there's not a lot of those around. As the climate has been changing, and we know why, people are causing that with greenhouse gases, but as the climate has been changing, the changes, as we've heard many times this week, are the fastest in the Arctic region, and there's a variety of well-known scientific reasons for that. But what that means is that what had been covered by hard, thick, basically permanent ice is now becoming much thinner, much less ice. And what that means is now we're starting to see greatly increased human activity. It's not happening all in one year. It's not all going to be in a nice straight line. There'll be ups and downs. But over time, we're seeing increases in the potential for fishing. We're seeing increases, as is already being talked about, in the ability to drill not only on land, but offshore. We see tourism coming up. We see the potential and the beginnings of the changes of global shipping routes. And the United States, along with Russia, shares the strategic choke point for the Arctic. Everything going into or out of the Arctic from the Pacific has to go through the Bering Strait, and we, along with Russia, control that strait. So what we're looking at from a security perspective is greatly increased human activity. So that just naturally leads to, you know, what you would call maybe constabulary issues, where the Coast Guard would lead. Now, fast forward to the last 18 months or so, and in addition to all of that change in human activity, we now have Russia, which is rebuilding their military Arctic capabilities. Now, they were at a very low level after the Cold War, so that in itself is not an issue. But we don't really understand what their intentions are. There's a lot of rhetoric put out by Russia. It's frankly bombastic. It's up for debate how much of that is for domestic Russian consumption. So you fall back and say, well, what are the actions of this country? And the actions of this country are they went and invaded a European country. So, you know, they fly military aircraft through Western European airspace, turning off their transponders. I mean, these are not the actions of normal, rational people.
So you're raising a cascading number of security issues that we're going to talk about in the second half of our show. Meteorologist David Titley with Penn State. After the break, we'll continue, as I said, this conversation about U.S. interests in the Arctic as it plays catch-up with Russia, China, and other nations in the region. And later on our talking point, an arrest for stealing snacks ended in death for Jamichael Mitchell. What the tragic case of one mentally ill man highlights about our criminal justice system. That's next on To the Point from PRI.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
And we're back with To The Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about President Obama's visit to the Arctic and his vision for a new Arctic plan. The U.S. is lagging far behind Russia and China in military presence and also commercial investment in the region. And the backdrop for these energy and security issues are rising seas and their devastating impact on the Arctic and global environment, as well as Alaskans' way of life. David Titley is director of Penn State University's Center for Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk, and he's a former oceanographer and a navigator for the U.S. Navy. And when we left off, you were talking about the a number of security concerns the U.S. has in the region. I'd like to give you a chance, David, to address then what the U.S. needs to put in place in order to better secure the area. What infrastructure should be there?
Sure. So thanks, Barbara. So really, you know, it would be wonderful if somebody could come and tell you exactly what the future 10, 20, 30 years was going to look like in a security perspective. But the answer is nobody can. So we need to basically hedge our bets, if you will, guard against the worst risks, and have some capability, some capacity, and be able to show not only ourselves but the rest of the world that we are capable of operating up in the Arctic. So what would that mean? There's been much in the press in the last not only week but really in the years about our lack of icebreakers, and I would not compare the numbers that we have to Russia, but rather what is it that the United States needs for its own needs? And the Coast Guard has done a number of studies on that. And the bottom line, without getting into a lot of details, is we need about 6, 3 medium and 3 heavy icebreakers. So that's something that's pretty tangible. But it's not just icebreakers. We need to understand what is going on in the Arctic as it opens up. The military term would be domain awareness. We need, frankly, better ice forecasting, better weather forecasting for a variety of needs, most of which are civilian. We need better charting capabilities. NOAA's making some progress on that, but much has to be done. We need ports. We need to figure out where should there be ports, because the nearest deep water port to the Arctic we have is Dutch Harbor. That would be like saying, I want to get stuff into Boston, Massachusetts, but I don't have a port any closer than Norfolk, Virginia. So we have a lot of work to do that's just basic type of work. For the military, just some basic exercises working in and near the Arctic, because it's different up there, as I think all the other panelists on this call could tell you, the Arctic is still a very, very harsh place to operate. It's austere. Communications are hard. Everything's harder at minus 30. And you don't learn that by a book. You learn that by actually operating in that environment. So this is not a huge space shot type thing that we need to do. We just need to pay some attention. And we could do that if we had the will.
David Titley with Penn State University's Center for Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk. Let's bring Heather Conley into the conversation. She's Senior Vice President for Europe, Eurasia, and the Arctic at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, or CSIS. And she co-authored the paper, The New Ice Curtain, Russia's Strategic Reach into the Arctic. Welcome to the show.
Great to be with you.
Well, we're talking about icebreakers. David Titley said the magic number is 6. Do you agree with that? And just stepping back for a moment, for all of us who weren't in the U.S. Navy, why do we need these icebreakers in the Arctic?
Well, I mean, I think very much to David's comment, what we need to have an understanding of what is our vision for the Arctic. And that helps us sort of answer the question, what are our infrastructure needs? icebreakers are the easiest way of getting our arms around readiness, preparedness. So the Coast Guard has made the assessment that it needs three heavy icebreakers, three medium icebreakers. Presently, we only have one heavy icebreaker, and that's pretty much dedicated to Antarctica. And then we have one medium strengthened icebreaker, the Healy, which is mostly for scientific research, but has multiple uses. We need that ice, and it seems I've heard some folks reflect to say, well, if the ice is disappearing, why do you need an icebreaker? It's exactly as David was explaining, that ice is breaking up. The flows are very different. You have multi-year ice. You have first-year ice. The storms are very severe. It's creating new patterns. The seasons, obviously, some are earlier than others. It makes it extremely difficult to operate in the Arctic. And heaven forbid if a cruise ship would become disabled or there would be need for an oil spill response, you need those icebreakers to get up. A few years ago, Nome, Alaska needed an emergency fuel shipment. Thankfully, a Russian fuel tanker was on the way, but the Healy needed to break the ice to get in there. So we do need this for national security, to protect Alaskans, protect our coastline, to make sure that we prevent illegal fishing, but making sure that people are safe in the Arctic.
Now, we've been framing this conversation in terms of a new Cold War in the Arctic. Can you flesh that out for us? Just how dominant is Russia in the region, and how much of a concern is it, or are we overstating the situation?
Russia is the big Arctic player. It has over 50% of the Arctic coastline that stretches over 10,000 miles. Currently today, over 20% of Russian gross domestic product comes from the Arctic, 22% of its exports. So the Arctic is incredibly important to Russia economically. And from a security standpoint, the Arctic is home to Russia's strategic nuclear deterrent in the Northern Fleet, its strategic submarine fleet. It has always played a very important role. The Arctic allows Russia, as it seeks access to both the North Atlantic and then the North Pacific. It's always been extremely important to Russia. For the United States, our security architecture is also in the Arctic. Our missile defense architecture stretches from Fort Greely, Alaska, all the way up to Thule Air Force Base in Greenland. So we do still have that security architecture. Admiral Titley was absolutely right. What Russia has been showing us over the last 12 to 18 months is increasing capability in the Arctic. So in March of this year, President Putin called the Russian Northern Fleet to full combat readiness, and a snap exercise which involved 45,000 Russian forces, 15 submarines, 41 warships. It was quite a display. It disturbed us because it was unannounced. Military exercises are usually announced, so we understand what's going on. We're not confused. We don't misinterpret that. We have seen a threefold increase in Russian military air incursions over Northern Europe, in the Arctic, even in the North American, close to our airspace identification zone. This is not behavior that supports international cooperation. And so we're not entirely sure what Russia's intentions are. We know they have very ambitious ideas to develop their Arctic, their resources, which should be considerable, their transit routes. But this type of behavior is the exact opposite for international cooperation. It raises more questions. So we said, look, we've got to get back to transparency. We've got to notify military exercises. We have to build confidence back into the system. We all want to cooperate in the Arctic. It's vital. Russia is a key player for that. But they have to start behaving in a transparent way,
right,
and to build confidence, not reduce it.
Heather Conley with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Frances Ulmer, chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission. I'd like you to elaborate on what Heather Conley was saying about the U.S. being late to the table, both in terms of national security and in an awareness of how important the Arctic is. Why is that? And what are the consequences of a late and unformed U.S. vision for the Arctic?
Well, the Arctic is a strategic location. There's no doubt about that for many, many reasons. And actually, our Navy has recognized that over a long period of time. We've had nuclear-powered submarines patrolling that region, still do for a long time. But I agree with David that the gap isn't so much between what the U.S. is doing and what Russia is doing, but more a gap between what our needs are and our capacities. And that's why I'm very glad that one of the announcements from President Obama's trip was expediting the construction of an icebreaker. It's one of many that we really need to do. You know, for a long time, people in Alaska were frustrated by how hard it has been to get the attention of people in the lower 48 on the Arctic, its strategic importance, its valuable resources, and its vulnerable ecosystems. But within the last few years, there's been a huge step up. The Obama administration adopted the National Arctic Strategy in 2013, an implementation plan for that strategy in 2014, and created the Arctic Steering Committee in January of this year, which is really much more focused in terms of not only the vision, the responsibility, the strategic investments that need to be made, but organizing the 30-plus federal agencies that have some responsibility toward the Arctic. So it's a glass half full and half empty. It's not enough. That is certainly true. But it is way more attention and resources coming out of not only the announcements this week associated with the Glacier Conference and the President's visits, but I think a growing awareness in the United States as a whole that what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic, that the United States is an Arctic nation and needs to stand up with the necessary commitment to enabling the readiness in case of shipping, tourism, fishing, oil and gas, or just being able to do the research. I would just say from a research perspective, a better understanding of the Arctic and what is happening in the Arctic and how that affects mid-latitude weather and many other ways that it affects global climate is incredibly important, and we need the resources to do that.
And you spoke to the frustrations of Alaskans. What do they think about the Russian presence in their region and the presence of other nations? Is it felt, and would they prefer more U.S. preference and resources?
Well, you know, Alaska has had a connection at a social, cultural, and economic level with the far east of Russia for a long time. The Chukchi population of Alaska Natives and the indigenous people in Russia, they can understand each other. They have hunted together. There is definitely a cultural tie. So when the U.S.-Russia relationship got better in the late 80s and early 90s, Alaskans were kind of at the forefront of building bridges across our border at a very personal and social and cultural level. So our attitude, frankly, up here is we need to work things out with the Russians, particularly, as David said, as it relates to the Bering Strait, which is bordered on one side by Russia and Alaska on the other, and is a very narrow passageway that all of the ships have to pass through that are either using the Northern Sea Route or the Northwest Passage. So we are very much a continuing player in building bridges with Russia in hopes that the cooperation on science, on shipping, on understanding cultural needs of our people and economic and social needs of our people could work together. In some periods, that's worked well. We hope that doesn't deteriorate any further.
Frances Ulmer, she's chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, meteorologist, former oceanographer, and member of the U.S. Navy, David Titley with Penn State. I'd like to pick up on the scientific research thread in this conversation, and specifically, Russia has submitted a bid to the United Nations for some 500,000 square miles of the Arctic seashelf. Now, this isn't only about science, this is about commerce. Why are they staking claims to the seabeds, and what does it mean that the U.S. hasn't staked their claim?
Well, that's a great question there, and the thing is, it's I think important to point out that Russia is, as much as you know, I have you know kind of pointed out their frankly illegal behavior. Their submission is exactly in accordance with an international treaty called the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea.
Which the U.S. hasn't signed.
Which every Arctic nation has ratified, except my little pop quiz I give my students is tell me what is in common with the United States, Syria, Libya, North Korea, Iran, and Iraq. And the answer is we are about the only countries that have a coastal border that have not signed the Law of the Sea. So we are the odd man out on this treaty. And yes, the Russians have submitted a very significant claim. What isn't always noted is the claim, though, is very, very similar to the one they submitted over a decade ago. I think it was 2002 or 2003. It was reviewed per the process by a commission in New York City, and they were basically the Russians were told, you need to go do more homework. So the Russians went and did more homework, and it gets mind-numbingly technical details that we won't go through here, but it's a whole lot of oceanographic surveys and understanding the bottom of the ocean and all kinds of stuff like that. They've done that work, and they've come back. Now, there's the Law of the Sea very specifically states if your claim overlaps with another country's and they're both valid claims, the deal is you need to go work that out with the other country. The commission in New York City is not going to make a ruling on that. So yes, the North Pole is part of Russia's claim, but it's also part of Denmark's claim. In fact, Denmark's claim goes all the way basically to the coastal waters of Russia. They go even further across. It's widely expected that Canada will put in a claim. We have done the work to do this. In fact, we have done years of surveys in the Arctic Ocean along with the Canadians. We would send a Canadian icebreaker and an American icebreaker, the Healy, as I think Fran has already mentioned there, and we have the data. But until we're a member of the treaty, until the Senate accedes to the treaty, we don't get a seat at the table. We don't get to make our claim. And this is something that is, frankly, it's a tragedy. It really is a tragedy that we seem not to have the political will to accede to this treaty. This treaty was written by American lawyers to lock in American advantages, and we have walked away from it.
David Tidley with Penn State. Francis Ulmer, chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission. This visit and this focus on the Arctic, it comes in Obama's last year of this eight-year term. I'd like to hear your comment, your thoughts about that, and how optimistic you are that whatever momentum has been started in these last few days and last few weeks would be continued.
Well, Barbara, I am an optimist, and I do see a lot of movement not only by the president and his staff, but by secretaries and their amazing resources with really step up their engagement with tribes, with local governments, with industry, and with the state of Alaska in recent years. It isn't just this trip. As I said, since 2013, when the National Arctic Strategy was adopted by the president, there has been a lot of homework done by the agencies. What's good news about that is a lot of that activity, I believe, will continue regardless of who is elected president, because these things have been set in motion and built into not only the agency plans and budgets, but also their awareness and understanding of the challenges in the Arctic and the responsibility of our nation toward the Arctic. I wish that all of this would have started even earlier, yes, because we do feel as though we are playing catch-up in some regard, but there is a wide variety of planning and commitment of resources that didn't exist before. And I am optimistic that will continue. I have to say,
great,
though,
and I hope we'll have you back on the show to talk more about how the progress does move forward. Frances Ulmer, she's chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission. Alex DeMarvin, a reporter with the Alaska Dispatch News, joined us earlier. David Titley, director of Penn State University's Center for Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk. And Heather Conley also took the time with us, senior vice president for Europe, Eurasia, and the Arctic at CSIS. There's always so much more to say, and I'm so sorry that each of you couldn't speak more. Thanks very much for joining us. And just ahead, there are approximately 10 times more mentally ill people behind bars than in psychiatric hospitals. What the death of a Virginia man 4 months after his arrest for just stealing snacks tells us about our criminal justice system. That's coming up on today's Talking Point after the break. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from PRI.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
I'm Barbara Bogavin for Warren Olney, here with today's Talking Point. Last month, a young African-American man died in a Virginia jail 4 months after being arrested for stealing just about $5 worth of junk food. 24-year-old Jamichael Mitchell was accused of stealing a Snickers bar, a Mountain Dew, and a zebra cake from a 7-Eleven. His family says he suffered from schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. And the courts were aware of his mental illness, yet found him unfit to stand trial. A judge recommended he be transferred to a mental health facility, but the transfer never happened. Slate's Dahlia Lithwick says this is just one example of an ongoing failure of the criminal justice system, its treatment of the mentally ill. And Dahlia, it is very good to talk with you again.
Oh, thank you for having me, Barbara.
So explain this very sad case for us. Who was Jamichael Mitchell, and what was known about his mental health during his incarceration?
Well, we don't know much. We know what his family has said. What they said is exactly as you outlined it, that he was picked up for stealing, you know, some snacks from a 7-Eleven in Virginia, in Hampton Roads, Virginia. And he was charged with petty larceny and trespassing. Bond was denied to him. And after a month, he finally had an encounter with a judge who said, oh, no, he's not fit to stand trial. He's had other encounters with the legal system. In fact, he seems to have been obsessed with this one particular 7-Eleven. He'd been warned not to go there. The judge said he's got to go to a state mental health facility, but 3 months later, still no beds were available to him. And the last thing we know is on August 19th, he's found dead in his cell.
Was he able to speak to family or friends? Did he have anyone advocating for him? And why was someone who needs medication, is on medication, needs attention, why wasn't he released on bail?
Well, on the first question, his family says they were trying to be in contact with him. They said he was so sick that he didn't put their names on a visitor's list, and so they were unable to access him. His aunt says she was routinely trying to call the jail and get in to see him. But your deeper question is, how is it possible that somebody who was so sick, he was assessed by a mental health expert who said he was clearly psychotic, he couldn't make any sense, he was manic, how is that person not under the treatment of a serious mental health program? And more urgently, how is he not on meds? The family is alleging that he simply refused to take his meds, and that, in fact, he refused to eat as well. And he ultimately, they say, wasted away over the course of these 4 months until he starved to death. But really, the question is, I think, how is it possible that in this country, according to the data that I dug up, we have 10 times more people with severe mental illnesses who are incarcerated in prisons than in mental health hospitals? In other words, this is now where, akin to 18th century England, this is where we warehouse our sickest people.
This is bedlam. Now, why wasn't he transferred? Who dropped the ball? And are you saying, I mean, how do you split the difference? Is it administration and agency-to-agency communication that's the problem, or is it resources?
Well, I think that Virginia has a long-standing problem. Virginia is spectacularly bad at finding hospital beds for mentally ill patients, and we have a long-standing, in this Commonwealth, a long-standing problem, including a really horrific case where a state senator was attacked by his own son, Cray Deeds. He visited the hospital with his son. He was in the prison system with his son. He said he needs a bed. The prison system was not able to find a psychiatric bed, and later that same day, his son, Gus Deeds, attacked his father, tried to kill him, ultimately killed himself. So we have a long, long history of the state legislature saying this is an ongoing challenge. We have literally had prison wardens saying, please direct some of my budget towards a mental health program so that we are not incarcerating the sickest of the sick. But I think it would be a mistake to say this is Virginia specific. This is partly a function of deinstitutionalization that happened decades ago, and homeless people and sick people who are on the streets who get swept up, not in any medical system, but get swept up into the criminal justice system. And we know, Barbara, because we've seen the data, another study just came out from the Urban Institute that shows that people who have severe mental illnesses, like Mitchell, tend to get treated incredibly poorly in prison. They're not medicated. They're not treated. They stay there far longer, and they tend overwhelmingly, compared to the rest of the prison population, to be either abused or to hurt themselves.
So what would it take to move the needle from on political will all the way to action on the issue for the incarcerated mentally ill? And are there class action suits that are moving through the courts now on this?
You know, I haven't seen class action suits. I do know that the big suit that people are talking about is the Sandra Bland suit. She was the woman in Texas who, you remember, was pulled over for failing to signal and a few days later hung herself in her jail cell. And that triggered not only a response by her parents with a lawsuit, but Texas is now undertaking to do, starting this month, a serious inquiry into how they treat the mentally ill in jail. But I think the deeper question is, jails are not working, and how are we going to find a way to treat folks in meaningful ways, not just warehousing them? And there are a couple of initiatives that are sort of interesting, including mental health courts, which is to say that you have the option, if someone is clearly schizophrenic or bipolar the way Mitchell was, to waive them into a mental health court where instead of punitive measures, there is treatment afforded. So there are several possibilities that are out there. But I think that just the American sort of horror of mental illness and the lack of a real constituency to lobby for this and to push for this, and certainly the lack of resources, nobody wants to put money towards these kinds of programs, mean that more and more we're just going to see people warehoused in jails being abused.
Well, I'm sure we're going to return to this issue on the show, and I hope with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Dolly Lithwick, she writes about the courts and law for Slate. And that's it for us for today. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. I'll see you tomorrow for To the Point, which is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.